fun night of games to get to. Let's get right to it. Talk about what we did for the NBA cast today. Sixers taking care of Indiana in Indiana. Pacers have now lost two straight after that 7-3 start that had us so excited. 7-5 isn't nearly as exciting. And Philly getting their first road win of the season. So both these teams now sitting at 7-5. What was your first or the most salient thing that you could take away from this one?
Well, I think there are two big angles on this game. So one is, while it's one opponent and one game, in this one opponent, one game situation, I thought Domantas Sabonis looked a lot better than Miles Turner. He made Joel Embiid work differently. He attacked mismatches more aggressively. And Philly tried something that has been a background concern for me for a little while now, as Miles Turner has forged an identity with his best skill being his jump shot, which is paralleling something that I think you're the first person I heard talk about this with Ryan Anderson a few years ago. The idea that if what somebody does primarily is jump shoot, you can put somebody smaller on them unless they have the right skills, and they can't really hurt you that much. And that was something Philly did at moments of this game. Sometimes they're playing Turner and Sabonis together, and Philly was putting Embiid on Sabonis, and then they were putting somebody smaller on Šarić, often on Miles Turner, and Miles Turner couldn't do a whole heck of a lot.
Well, and more importantly, Indiana tried to get him to do a whole heck of a lot, and they tried to post him up. I mean, he played 30 minutes. He was 2-for-8. And he and Sabonis played a lot more together in this game than we normally see. In fact, McMillan kind of sounded like he had said that lineup was going to be dead, but with Thad Young really struggling offensively, he only played 21 minutes in this game. He was -16. I still might have tried to go to him over Turner just for the defense, because I didn't think Turner helped the defense a ton in this one. But yeah, I mean, he's just, Miles Turner just isn't a good post-up player. Like, it's, we saw him like try to post up on Kyle Korver last year. He couldn't do it. Like, he's just not strong enough to get the real juicy stuff that a post-up against a smaller player is supposed to get, right? The reason that you go, you know, unless you're like a Kevin Durant type of jump shooter, the reason you want to get a big against a small is so he can back down and just use his superior size and either get fouled or get a very close in shot. And Turner just doesn't really have that in his game. But the more worrisome thing to me is just how few three-pointers he's taking. We talked about this on the 15 and 60 that he's under 2 a game. He was passing up a ton of wide open threes at times in this game. And I don't know whether that's McMillan saying that he shouldn't do that, or a lack of confidence, or just his wanting to establish himself in some other way. I mean, he already got paid. And, you know, McMillan did have these somewhat troubling comments earlier in the week that, hey, you know what, we're not Golden State and we're not Boston. So, you know, we're the Pacers and we're not going to shoot as many threes, even though they have really good three-point shooters on this team. And so I think Turner, if he's not going to space out, especially going against Joel Embiid too. I mean, that's the other thing. Now, the Sixers did guard him with a smaller player at times, but nonetheless, I mean, space the floor for your guys, because really, like, Embiid was just a massive force in the lane. The Pacers really could not get anything going after the first quarter or so. And so I just didn't like how he was used. I didn't like how he was using himself. And, you know, again, we saw Sabonis be more effective than him as well, including one just massive dunk, which was awesome. Sabonis had 16 points in this one. So I'm in agreement. I just, you know, Turner just doesn't seem to be taking these next steps that we wanted to see from him.
And part of this is Turner not doing what we hoped, but another part is giving praise to Sabonis. I mean, Sabonis doesn't wow you other than that dunk, which was ridiculous. I mean, my current dunk of the season favorite.
There's a meme of us on Twitter that'll show just how wowed we were. Someone got a screenshot.
Well, and it was shocking beyond all the Sabonis dunking on Joel Embiid elements. It was how it happened. It was just kind of driving down the lane, and then it just all of a sudden he showed a little bit more burst, not only vertically but more laterally. He took off from further away than Sabonis usually does on dunks, and I'm sure it surprised Embiid. And it's more than just that, though. I mean, Sabonis, he doesn't stick, like, in the offense. If the ball gets to him and there's a decision to make, he does so quickly and gets the ball to a player in a reasonable spot for them to succeed. There was one three-pointer, I think it was Corey Joseph, I can't remember who it was, who it basically happened just because the ball moved quickly. And defensively, he's kind of in the way. I mean, he's definitely not a perfect player there, but he can do that. You know, he had a fair amount of defensive rebounds in this game, ended up with 8, which was more than twice as many as Miles Turner had had in the game. And it's not going to be this, you know, the flashy blocks that Miles Turner had. And he had one of those in this game. And then he had another one that was a little bit more conventional. But those, I tried to draw a distinction on the NBA cast between shot blockers and rim protectors. And neither one of these guys is really a rim protector, but the shot blocking that Turner provides and the difference between that and Sabonis isn't so great that I think there's this big like gulf, which you could guess with their athleticism difference, but that doesn't really exist.
Yeah, I'm in agreement there. And, you know, with Sabonis under contract for well under $5 million. Actually, now he's the 11th pick, so he might be getting up close to there next year. But yeah, and Turner going in to be making $18 million a season, you know, you do wonder about that decision.
I thought you were going to lead in there to talking about Sabonis' strength.
Well, yeah.
That was a story.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think that was the one thing, because, you know, we're always like, oh, he can only shoot left-handed. Like, and he actually had a couple of right-handed plays. You know, he's getting a little bit more there. You can tell it's not second nature for him yet. It's sort of like, oh, I guess this is one of those ones that the coach said I should shoot with my right hand, so I guess I will. But even that is progress, you know, from where he was last year. And he definitely does work hard. But yeah, I mean, I think the fact that he's been able to be so effective only having that left hand, it's because he's just so strong. I mean, he went through Embiid, albeit with a little bit of an offensive foul at the right arm, but that's all right. It was a spectacular dunk. I'm not going to kill him too badly on that one. And then, you know, he had another finish where he just had guys bouncing off him. He's able to just, even when guys cut him off, he's still able to just kind of go through them with that shoulder, get to that left-handed hook shot in the lane. But, you know, really, I think this game was more about the Sixers, frankly, which is, it's kind of funny because through most of the game, it felt like the Pacers were outplaying them. And Oladipo was awesome. He had 22 in the first half. It struggled more in the second and finished 14 out of 30, which is a ton of shots. But I thought that Joel Embiid didn't have his best offensive game. He had 12 in the first half, it finished with 20, but it was really spectacular in the first quarter, I thought, going at Turner. And then they kind of got a little bit away from that. But it just, that Sixers defense came back. And part of that, too, is that, you know, they've struggled with stretch options on Embiid. Well, you know, they found someone for Embiid to guard, whether it was Young, whether it was Sabonis. Turner wasn't spacing it out. I thought Covington had a fantastic defensive game. And again, because the Pacers just don't really space it out. They don't run anything incredibly sexy either. You know, that was another thing I noticed from the Pacers, is it's just, you know, their actions don't really flow together. You know, it's kind of, okay, we're going to set a screen for Oladipo, but then he's going to get to the top of the key and take another three steps away from the basket. It's just simply, let's get him the ball, but then he's going to take three steps away from the basket, turn around, and the defense will be set when he gets it. You know, he's not catching on the move, really. There's very few actions where they're catching it on the move if they're the Pacers. And so when Philly is able to set their defense, Simmons had a pretty good defensive game as well. Embiid can get into position. They don't really have anyone who is going to kill Dario Saric either. And Saric broke out in a big way finally from his shooting slump with 4-6 from downtown and was a positive player for the first time in a while here. This Philly defense can look really good against more of a conventional style team. And that's, while the Pacers might have the personnel to not be so conventional, they certainly play extremely conventionally.
Yeah, and that like ties in with the second storyline for me, which is also how much better Philadelphia's offense looks when their role players are hitting shots. Because there were elements of this game, like the first half, I mean, where those guys weren't hitting shots. Redick didn't make a three in this entire game. Embiid, you know, limited there. And then Covington and Saric came on late. And once that happened, including some interesting lineups where they're fiddling with Saric and Simmons at the four and the five, which was fascinating, and playing Fultz and Simmons together, but all three of the other guys could shoot.
Yeah.
That was
interesting. They didn't have Embiid or Johnson on the floor with those two guys. So the idea was that they could operate with a little more space. I think that had some success tonight.
It had some success. I mean, there were some help defensive problems there, as you would expect when you don't have guys that really have those responsibilities. But I like to see Brett Brown trying things. And I mean, the bigger argument I talked about in the 15 and 60 is that I think Fultz and Simmons are more duplicative than collaborative, at least at this point in each of their respective developments. But they're, you know, try things out. That's what the regular season is for. And if you can do it without losing a game, something else from the Sixers perspective, I'm hoping this changes. I'm expecting this to change, but Wilson Chandler just looks slow out there. You know, last year he had a run rough season with the Nuggets, it was an idea of kind of like lagging indicators because he had been productive and some would argue unheralded earlier in his Nuggets career. And then last year he looked shaky. And then, you know, coming back from this hamstring issue, he still looks shaky and they need that to get better. Theoretically, Zaire Smith coming back from the Jones fracture eventually could help, but that's relying on
he's
a rookie.
He's not going to be able to shoot at an NBA level. I would be very surprised.
Right. So we're not all the way there yet, but this is looking kind of like what we saw last year where the Sixers have a couple of bench guys they can trust. And this year it's different because they're not starting Redick, at least for now. So if you're counting him as a bench guy, that's a bench guy you can trust. Shamit's doing what, you know, he's kind of fulfilling a role. And I enjoy when they play those two guys together because sometimes they just run like duplicate JJ Redick stuff for them at the same time, which I just enjoy. Not something you get to see very often in NBA offenses. But outside of those guys, I mean, Amir Johnson, again, he looks slow too. Like he doesn't look like the same guy that was in Toronto a few years ago or even that first year on the Celtics. And that means they're probably looking at the buyout market. All those sorts of things. The Sixers are good enough where they can survive a lot of this. But if we're talking about the playoffs, I mean, they needed Ersan Ilyasova. They needed Marco Bellinelli. And maybe Shamet replaces Bellinelli, but then they need Ilyasova.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it's not like they shot amazingly well from three, but at least the guys who don't hit them as much, you know, Šarić in particular, you know, to be able to space the floor and get guard out there was key. And I thought Covington, he was only 2 of 6 from three, but he had both of his threes and also a ridiculous twisting layup and one, a personal 9-0 run in the third quarter, which was really when Philly surged out to the lead. And Fultz, you know, 26 minutes tonight was actually plus 14. You know, he wasn't incredibly efficient. He, again, wasn't looking to shoot outside at all. He took a couple of jump shots. He missed some real easy layups. I mean, it's good that he can at least get to those layups. And he also had one dunk where he came down the lane, but, you know, Indy just didn't help at all. So, you know, some baby steps there, finding a way to play Simmons and Fultz together. Yeah, what were you going to say?
Something else that helped Marco Fultz in this game is that particularly Darren Collison, but generally speaking, the Pacers point guards just weren't that involved in the offense. And so Oladipo was dominant. And I mean, if Oladipo is scoring and driving the way that he did for portions of this game, it makes sense. But that leaves a little bit of a seam for a guy like Marco Fultz, who is definitely limited defensively, had a couple of breaks. Farts in this game as he usually does, and young guys do, and Markel Fultz had them in college and high school too. So the Pacers, it's so strange. Like I can understand the idea of using your point guard as a spot up shooter if you're relying a lot on another player. You know, various teams have done that, but it just seemed like the ball was never really finding those guys when Oladipo was on the floor, and that leads to a point that you and I have both discussed and will continue to as the team building for the Pacers extends with cap space and everything like that. Because if you're not going to use that person as even a secondary playmaker most of the time, you can go for some different skill sets there. You don't have to have somebody who's 6'2".
Yeah, I mean, it's like it seems like McMillan's like, well, I need to have a point guard on the floor. But, you know, especially at the end of the half and the end of the game, like, they run pick and roll for Oladipo every single play. So, like, what is the point of having Collison out there when you could go with someone who's a little bit better defensively? And they do go with Joseph there, but then he takes stuff off the table offensively. However, I'm not sure who they necessarily could have put in. McDermott struggled tonight. Missed his two shots, wasn't really able to get open. And then Tyreek, I thought he looked like he was just running in molasses the whole game. I mean, you know, he's got a nice Euro step. He's worked on his jump shot a lot. He deserves a ton of credit for that. But he doesn't look to be in great shape. I mean, just his activity level is very low. You know, any kind of thing where he's got to do a DHO or something, like he's just not moving very fast, not eluding his defender. Guys are denying him the ball really easily, like forcing him way out on the floor. And then anytime he doesn't have the ball, if something is called for him to make a cut, he's just going to jog through it. He's not going to actually get open or, you know, suck the defense in with a back cut or something like that. And defensively also, I thought this was not one of his better games. You know, this is, I've only seen a couple of Pacers games so far. You know, I've been reading J. Michael. He says that Tyreek's actually been okay on defense this year. But, you know, I didn't really see that in this game, to be honest.
And it can be really hard for a player with Tyreek's early success to adjust to, even if he has a higher usage role as a bench player. I mean, last year he had a high usage rate. He was the best player on the Memphis Grizzlies full stop, not the best bench player or anything like that. Maybe he's having a challenge engaging with that, even though he is on a more competitive team this year than what ended up happening in Memphis last year. Maybe we caught him on an off night. That's why we try to watch teams more frequently, is because you never know what sample you're getting and whether it's totally representative. But it was concerning all the same. And that's why when I talked about the Pacers potentially, you know, the point guard idea, I said it more as a team building thing, because I agree with you that they don't really have that personnel right now. But when they think about what they want to do with their flexibility moving forward, it is a significant consideration. And something else that was, you talked a little bit about Thaddeus Young, his limitations defensively, but something that I thought really affected the tenor of this game early, he had 3 turnovers in like the first 3 minutes of this game. And that led the Sixers to go on a run. The Pacers, of course, eventually made it a game again, and it wasn't like it affected it, but that helped give the Sixers some cushion so that what the Pacers were always kind of coming back and then maybe taking a slight lead rather than building up a lead and then the Sixers coming back, which, you know, the Sixers go out to leads all the time and lose them, but it was still, I thought it was still significant even later in the game once it gotten close again.
I think that's about all I have on this one. As listeners know, I just got married, and so we got our photos back, got a bunch of really good ones. And now that you're married, I've been putting it off a long time, but apparently you're supposed to do holiday cards now. And just so happens, we have all these great official photos from the wedding photographer. And I was really dreading having to do holiday cards. It's just like, it seems like such an annoying process. But with Minted, it was incredibly easy. All I had to do was text a photo to cards. That's 22737. And then Minted Stylist actually texts us back with 5 hand-selected designs. We haven't decided exactly which ones we're going to do yet, but these are actually created by independent artists. They showcase the photo, and we get free custom envelopes and recipient addressing in a variety of matching designs and hand-styled fonts. If only we had known about Minted before we had to do our thank you notes, then we really would have saved a lot of time and actually made them look a lot cooler than the ones that we got. So now we've got everyone's addresses from the weddings. We can just plug those into Minted and send our Christmas cards, which are going to look awesome with the photos from the wedding, thanks to Minted. So once again, the way to get started with them, text your photo to cards. That's 22737. New customers get 20% off, but only through November 30th. Once again, that's 22737 cards before November 30th and get 20% off your first purchase. Get started right now. Once again, text your picture to 22737. All of their orders are 100% guaranteed. All right, so we'll do a little bit of a different approach for the other two games we're going to talk about because
Wait, actually, before we get to the other two games, I forgot that we had a couple of good stats generated by our NBA cast director of foresight, Ben Dole.
Director of basketball research. Liam.
Sorry, I'll get it at some
Liam
point.
Liam is director of insight and foresight.
Okay, I'll get it at some point. But we asked him to pull some stuff, and I actually thought these told a good story of the game. So Oladipo started out really hot on pull-ups. I think he had 5 points on 3 pull-ups in the beginning of the game. Ended up with 5 on 12, 9 three-pointers off the dribble, 3 two-pointers, and then 9 points on 5 catch-and-shoots. That's almost 2 points per possession. Then Embiid had 7 points on 11 post-up possessions, split between Turner and Sabonis, and then one weird one on Corey Joseph.
Yeah, I'd like to see them run more stuff off the ball for Oladipo. Like, he is a pretty good catch and shoot guy, and he's so fast that he can really elude guys on those plays. And then if they overcommit, he can actually curl into the lane and get something. But again, you know, they just don't run enough of that stuff, I don't think. And then Embiid's post up, you know, he had a lot of success early against Turner, but largely it got shut down there. But it ended up not mattering. I mean, this was a defensive game, pretty fast paced. It was 100 possessions and, you know, 194. And that was even with some garbage time buckets late. It ended up not being quite as close as that 6-point score would have indicated. But where do you want to go next? We're just going to talk about the fourth quarter of these other two games, since that's all we really had time to go through.
Let's go to the game that was occurring at the same time we were doing the NBA cast. Denver, Memphis. Wow, I can talk. It's not midnight. And this was, I mean, you see the score 89-87. You go, oh my God, like it's a, you know, a throwback game. It also was an incredibly slow game by modern standards, 88 possessions. So I mean, it was still a defensive slog and all that kind of stuff. And it was looking that way when the fourth quarter started. And one of the first things that stood out to me was the matchup between Jaren Jackson Jr. and Mason Plumlee. And on the first possession of the fourth quarter, Jaren drove all the way to the bucket on Plumlee. Plumlee, you know, a very capable, one of the better backup centers in the entire league, but that's not really something he could do, you know, get all the way out there. And Jaren played power forward a lot at Michigan State. I think he can take advantage of that matchup. But then later on, we saw some of the power forward in Jaren Jackson come into play where he wasn't exactly in the right place defending pick and rolls. And so Denver was getting some cleaner looks than you'd expect because he wasn't, you know, he wasn't in the right place for the alley-oop or he wasn't anything like that. And that's not a criticism necessarily of Jaren Jackson. He just is going to take him some time. But one of the things that I kept on thinking about during this, because I didn't know the full context of the game, was where the hell is Paul Millsap? And the resolution on it is something that makes some sense to me, which is a player who is dealing with a nagging injury but still playing. And so Millsap was in the game for 20 minutes, but he didn't apparently, like, his stat line doesn't look like himself. It doesn't appear that he looked like himself, but he is still playing. He just didn't play in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, Lyles and Hernan Gomez, I think they went the entire fourth quarter with both of those guys on the floor at the three and the four. The biggest thing that struck me, and this game was close most of the way in the fourth, I just thought that the Nuggets were getting way better shots. I mean, they were just bricking open three after open three in this one, and a number of them that just spun out of the basket too. I mean, now Memphis didn't shoot any better. Denver was 1 out of 8. Memphis was 1 out of 7 from three in the final period, and 6 out of 21 and 8 out of 21 overall shooting. The Grizz got to the line, which the Nuggets were unable to do. And Trey Lyles missed a big free throw late on an and one that could have been a huge play. But I mean, I think the Nuggets actually out executed the Grizzlies in the fourth quarter and just were not able to make the shots, which were some pretty decent ones from good shooters too.
Something else that reared its head a couple of times in the fourth quarter, especially in the last 2.5 minutes, was just strangely lax passing by the Nuggets. Like there was a play where they turned the ball over, and there was another one where they weren't really getting pressured by Memphis, but they floated in an entry pass, and it didn't become a turnover, but it disjointed the possession a little bit. And this team has capable passers. There was also one where Jamal Murray threw the ball on a, you know, trying to seeing eye get it to Nikola Jokic, and it was too low, and that became a turnover as well. And, you know, it's not something that I consider a hallmark of a negative thing for Denver. I mean, this year, they're middle of the road in terms of turnovers. I believe that's about where they were last year. But in big moments, especially when you're facing a capable team, those can be more convoluted.
A few other notes that I mean, you mentioned the pace. Memphis is dead last in offensive pace, you know, the number of seconds it takes them to get a shot or a turnover. And, you know, they really imposed their will in terms of pace in this game. You know, Denver, I think really only the two times that they were able to run, they got great shots with Wancho getting a layup. And then they ran a drag string with Jokic. Everybody closed out on Jokic. He found Murray. Murray had a wide open three that he just couldn't make. What do you make of Jokic taking so few shots last night against the Celtics as well? Or I guess I can't remember if it was last night or two nights ago that Murray, yeah, it was 2 nights ago that Murray had the 48. You know, Jokic took like 3 shots there. Is that a concern to you?
Yes, it is. I mean, he did get 4 free throws. Oh, hey, big spender. And not only that, but Jokic's only shot of this game was the last shot of this game, which is bizarre for a guy who plays 26 minutes and is the team's best offensive player.
He was in foul trouble all game too, which I think that in particular makes him a lot less aggressive because so much of his game.
He gets offensive fouls.
So much of his game is, you know, using his size to get into position, you know, and really work guys in the post. But, you know, I thought Marc Gasol, I mean, I think it's pretty clear to me that he's back. You know, I thought he was cooked last year, but it seems like actually, no, he's looked pretty good. And this Grizzlies defense, they've got a lot of size, man. I mean, like, you think of their starting lineup, Gasol is huge at 7'1". Jackson is, you know, huge wingspan, 7'4", pretty good mobility. I mean, how many teams have someone like him at the four, even as a rookie? And then Kyle Anderson at the three, he's got a 7'4" wingspan as well. And, you know, a team like the Nuggets doesn't really have a player who's going to be able to take advantage of Anderson's lack of quickness. Now, the Grizz have absolutely no scoring. I mean, their offense is not good. But if they can continue to defend this way, all season, I think they can be in the playoff mix. If, as appears, you know, I don't know if the eighth seed is going to take 47 wins to get to in the West like it did last year necessarily, although certainly when teams start with the tank, that can change, and a lot of these teams will start playing better down the end.
Yeah, that's true. Something else that was striking, not only in the fourth quarter, but also I looked back because I wanted to check for the rest of the game. Memphis only took 70 shots from the field in this game, but 31 of them were in the restricted area, and they got to the line 25 times in this game, so they were getting a lot on the interior. They only took four long twos in the entire game. Only made one of them, but it doesn't matter if you only take four.
So Memphis, that's a two outside the lane, basically, is what you're saying is a
yes.
one-two, yeah.
Yeah. A mid-range shot, I guess, would be a way of putting it. And, yeah, I mean, they were getting... And in the fourth quarter, you know, maybe they're getting to a runner. There was one, actually, where I thought Trey Lyles did a nice job defending Marc Gasol, but Marc Gasol can make that shot. And I think Denver is really, you know, like, when I watched that fourth quarter and seeing... Not that Memphis was getting a ton of good shots. They got some. I agree with you that Denver got better shots, but you could see them missing Paul Millsap just because Millsap battles for defensive rebounds. He makes a lot of those plays more challenging. And also, it puts so much on Lyles and Hernan Gomez's shoulders. And I thought, to me, they looked a little bit fatigued by the end of this, which makes complete sense when you're a guy who's usually coming off the bench and plays the entire fourth quarter.
Yeah, although Lyles, I thought, did play pretty well. I mean, he was second on the team with 16 points and was one of the few to play efficiently. It was a wild last 2 minutes, though. Grizz led 83-82. I'm sorry, Nuggets actually led 83-82 with a minute 51 left. Grizz called timeout. And Shelvin Mack makes a three on a miscommunication, most likely between Lyles and Hernan Gomez. Things got switched around, so Lyles was guarding Gasol, and Hernan Gomez was on Mack. And Mack has actually been more aggressive shooting the three. I thought he looked good in that against the Warriors, the game we saw in person on Friday or on Monday night. So you would think two like-sized guys, both kind of power forward size, that's an auto switch. But Lyles just stayed back in the lane on that pick and roll, and Hernan Gomez apparently thought he was going to switch. He didn't. And so that's how Mack was able to bang the three. That was the biggest shot of the game to put the Grizz up two. And then the other key shot for the Grizz late was Conley splitting the defense. He got past Jokic, who he's been getting a lot of hype for his defense. And I've never thought that he just like sucked. But on this play, he was too slow. Conley, they've been bringing Jokic further out on the floor. Conley was able to split the defense, get in the lane, and go to that patented 12-foot floater. Anything on any of that? Or should we continue the answer?
Yeah. I wanted to say that I thought Lyles did a nice job recovering over on that Conley drive, because otherwise he would have gotten right to the basket and forcing the floater. Conley is amazingly proficient at that shot, but he realized, you know, okay, that's a better place for me to be. And also on that play, Denver, it appeared to me, deliberately did not have Jokic on Gasol. So JB Bickerstaff, right play, just didn't have Marc Gasol set the screen. They set the screen with Jaren Jackson Jr., who Jokic was guarding. Conley wrong foots him, gets into the lane, and gets that floater.
Yeah, then the Nuggets call timeout. I thought they did a nice job trying to set up the 2-for-1 down two possessions, and they ended up getting it in a roundabout way, but they went right away. They tried to get Lyles on a back door. Jokic completed the pass, but Lyles was stuck under the backboard, swung it outside, and then Jamal Murray was able to drive the closeout, find Lyles for a lay-in, and Marc Gasol actually got him on the arm, but Lyles missed a key free throw that could have put the Nuggets within one. Instead, though, they did get the 2-for-1, and I misspoke here. Lyles missed the free throw, but it actually worked out for the Nuggets because Hernan Gomez got the offensive rebound, and Jamal Murray, with that 14-second shot clock, made one right at the end of the clock there off the offensive rebound, a 21-footer to tie it. He had a really rough game. He was 6 out of 21 after that 48 the other night, but was able to hit some shots in the fourth quarter.
And so then that tied the game. Murray hit this. He had a step back two. To me, it looked like his foot was on the line, but not like his foot was on the line. It was almost a three, yeah. Just his foot was on the line. And so then Mike Malone brought in Mason Plumlee to replace Jokic. No problem with that. I mean, he's a better defensive player than Jokic. Jokic had just gotten wrong-footed by Conley to get the floater that put Memphis up four. And they run not a Conley-Gasol pick and roll, but a Shelvin Mack-Gasol pick and roll. And Jamal Murray, you know, they got the ball to Marc Gasol, and Jamal Murray just fouled him on the drive, and Gasol is a very good free-throw shooter. hits both those to put it up to a 2-point margin.
Yeah, and that was a point of education play, right? Where there's only 5 seconds left, basically, you know, as the play ran down. And so the Nuggets, usually with under 5 seconds, you'll be in a switch, especially because the Grizz don't have a ton of guys who are going to go one-on-one. There isn't really time to get into a post-up at that point. But Gasol did a great job, slipped the screen. Murray was not able to get in front of him. He had to grab him with two hands. And you could tell he almost realized what he was doing, like, oh shit, I shouldn't do this. But once you get two hands around the guy as he's cutting to the rim, the refs are really looking for that in the freedom of movement. And so Gasol makes both free throws. Then the Nuggets tried to run the old fake DHO that everyone is running now at the end of the game. And instead, Jokic just turned and was open for a three because Gasol kind of backed off a little bit to take away the drive off the DHO and got a pretty good look at it. But his first shot of the game missed. And Murray got the offensive rebound for a tip. I thought he had a pretty good look at it, but he ended up airballing it way short, and the Nuggets fall to 8-2.
Yeah, so I would say this is a far more significant win for Memphis than it is a loss for Denver, but it is still, you know, affects the dynamics in the Western Conference playoff picture preliminarily. And yeah, a very, very nice win for Memphis to just battle through it and get it. And another team that is benefiting from competence top to bottom. I mean, their lineup got ravaged by injuries last year, and they're still dealing with it. I mean, Jermichael Green is out right now. Chandler Parsons is out right now. But having players like Garrett Temple, having Wayne Selden and Dylan Brooks on their bench, you know, those guys aren't necessarily setting the world on fire, but they aren't going to make as many mistakes, and they're, you know, they have enough capable depth. And so I think that's really helping Memphis as well as their defensive excellence so far.
All right, before we move on to LA and Minnesota, this from Proper Cloth. They know that finding a dress shirt that fits is pretty difficult at 6'6", 6'9" wingspan, by the way. Same height and wingspan as Doug McDermott, by the way. It is hard for me to find shirts that fit. For me, if the arms are long enough, the trunk is always too wide. The armpits are too wide. It just, you don't get that seam right under your armpits where it's supposed to go if you want a proper slim fitting shirt. But with Proper Cloth, a custom fit shirt has never been easier. You can create a custom shirt size in seconds by answering 10 simple questions. You can have 20 collar styles. You can even look like Brian Colangelo if you want to. 10 cuff styles, 500 fabric styles, from classic to business to casual to business casual. Even customize your shirt, get the style that you want. Each one of their shirts goes through extensive quality control testing. You're getting the absolute best quality and craftsmanship, and they guarantee a perfect fit. So if somehow your shirt doesn't fit perfectly, they will remake it for free. Best of all, they start at just $80. So you don't have to wear shirts that don't fit anymore. Look your best with a custom fitted shirt. Go to propercloth.com/capspace today and enter gift code capspace to save $20 on your first shirt. Easy to remember, we talk about capspace all the time on the program. That's propercloth.com/capspace. Enter gift code capspace to save $20 on your first shirt and let them know that you came from us. So I don't think we need to spend quite as much time on this one. I think maybe the biggest thing was that Tyson Chandler actually closed this game and actually had 3 offensive rebounds in the last minute. And gave them a little more size. He had some pretty good defense on Karl Anthony Towns earlier in the game. It was another struggle fest for Towns at 5 out of 16 from the field, 1 of 6 from 3. We mostly were focused on the fourth quarter here of this one. What were your thoughts?
A lot more Rajon Rondo than Lonzo Ball. I'm not even sure if Lonzo played in the fourth quarter. I watched most of the second half of this game. I mean, that was a small sample. I didn't think Rondo was playing well enough that you have to go to him. And for whatever reason, whether it's Luke, LeBron, or both, they seem to be trusting Rondo, whatever that means. And I still continue to like Josh Hart and his fit with LeBron. And I understand, considering some of the constraints and considerations involved, why he's not starting now that Brandon Ingram is back. But I just love his fit with LeBron. I think they should try to maximize that as best they can. And Minnesota, I mean, I remain completely convinced that Tom Thibodeau is never going to, not even maximize. Maximize is too lofty a standard for me here. Capably utilize what Karl Anthony Towns does well. Some of that is because of spacing. Some of that is because they have so many guys that want the ball in his hands. But I mean, it just, there's so many times you're sitting there going, this guy is special. Develop something that shows everybody how special he is.
That said, Karl Towns has sucked this year. Like, he can't score in the post. He had 6 turnovers tonight. He was 5 out of 16. I mean, he had opportunities, and you know, and this is on a night when they made a franchise record 23 pointers. They were 20 out of 40 from downtown, and they shot only 41% on two-pointer. And Towns, I mean, you know, he only took two foul shots. He was terrible on the defensive glass. One of those ones at the end wasn't his fault because he was switched out onto LeBron when LeBron took a three. But the other two, he was in position on Chandler, wasn't able to box him out, wasn't able to rise up above the crowd for a rebound. And I mean, you know, he needs to be able to beast guys in the post. I mean, he's like goes up against a Brandon Ingram and just like can't get a good shot. I mean, I don't know if he's just not going hard enough, if he's not in shape, if it's just a mental issue dating back to last year's playoffs and like the whole Butler saga. I don't know what it is, but like some of it has to go on him. Like he has not played well this year with the chances that he's gotten. And even when he wasn't getting enough shots last year, and even with this spacing and this antiquated system and all this, he still was extremely efficient last year. And that just simply has not been the case this season. So I think he deserves, you know, certainly Thibodeau could be maximizing him, but Towns, you know, has not looked like the player who earned a 5-year max contract, and he's certainly not anywhere close to, especially if Denver keeps playing well, that's going to be a big problem for him, for making all NBA. He's going to cost himself $30 million if this keeps up.
Towns is below 50% from the field this year. I mean, that's shocking for a guy with his skill set, and right now averaging 2.3 assists per game, which, I mean, some of that is just the ball not being in his hands enough. But yeah, that's certainly a fair thing, and I'm happy you mentioned that, because Towns has not been overall at the level that we wanted, much less the level he was at last year. And I mean, that's not the threshold for a guy who's as talented as Towns is and as young as he is. Remember that he turns 23 in like a week, and there should be so much more room for him to grow. And maybe there's just some sort of curse with Minnesota giving guys max extensions, who knows. But it certainly is a disappointing part of this, and it is a storyline for Minnesota the rest of the year. I do not think this is like his destiny, that Towns is going to struggle like that for the rest of the year, but as you said, it is something worth watching. And another game where Derrick Rose hits a bunch of shots. I mean, he was 7 of 9 from three in this game, including a couple of big ones late. He did miss on the last shot of the game, which actually could have won it depending on what would have happened after that for Minnesota. And I didn't see a foul on that play. It looked to me like high five contact, which I have no problem with. But if that's what they're relying on to a point, Minnesota is relying on to get some of this offense, it could continue, but I wouldn't expect it. I mean, generally speaking, gravity affects all of these things. And even if he is a much better shooter than before, much better and 7 of 9 from three are not the same thing.
Oh, sure. Yeah. But I think like he actually, you know, I've watched Derrick Rose warm up many times. And when he was at Golden State over the weekend, I watched him. He actually was really hitting shots and warmups from three, which we have not seen as much from him lately. Also really interesting, I mean, the standoff between Butler and Tibbs continues, with Tibbs playing Butler 43 minutes. I guess if general soreness is going to be an issue, Tibbs figures in the games he plays, he might as well run him into the ground. So 43 minutes for Butler. The most any Minnesota bench player played was 12 minutes in this game. Every starter played 37 minutes or more. Wiggins 41, Butler 43, Towns 39. This Lakers starting lineup is interesting now. They've gone with really a jumbo size starting lineup. Ball is the smallest guy. Ingram is really the two. LeBron at the three. Kuzma at four. LeBron doesn't like to play four. Definitely doesn't like to play five. And then they have McGee, who had another nice offensive game in this one. And then they closed with Chandler and Rondo in place of Ball and JaVale. The Lakers got some atrocious shots late, in part because on those Tyson Chandler tip-outs, they only had 14 seconds to get into it. But LeBron, I mean, he was just dribbling around at half court on a lot of those and, you know, waiting until there was like four on the shot clock to even start. Like, he really looked, I don't know if he was tired or what, but he just, or just kind of arrogantly believed that he was going to make the tough three-pointer. He took 9 three-pointers in this one. A bunch of them were tough late. He was 3 out of 9. I did like that we saw Brandon Ingram, who had 20 points on 15 shooting possessions in this one, 6 assists. He had a really nice game. He stepped into a three a couple feet behind the line from the top of the key and transitioned and drained it. Like, that type of confidence is what you really want to see from him. And then, I mean, it's other than that, this Minnesota team, I mean, I've seen a lot of them in the last couple of weeks. It's got to just be so weird. I mean, Butler in and out of the lineup, Rose misses a couple of games. He's had 31 and 50 point games and then like not played at all in a bunch of some of these other games. Like, Jeff Teague has been out. He's missed his fifth straight with the knee injury. They really just have very little continuity on this team. Andrew Wiggins has 17 points in the first half and 2 points in the second half. I mean, it's got to be really, I have no idea what to expect from them. And if you're on this team, you've got to feel the same way, certainly. Also, it was encouraging to see Lance Stephenson only get 4 minutes. I think that's more the direction they need to be going. I mean, they are going with this jumbo group now, with Ingram playing 35 minutes. KCP has really been struggling. You know, he has had this knee tendonitis, and he only played 13 minutes. And Hart, you know, maybe you would like to see him play a little bit more. I wouldn't mind seeing, if they're going to go with this, why not just play Hart instead of Ball or Rondo, if they're going to stick with the traditional center. And they had a traditional center on the floor every minute of the game here. Chandler was 23 minutes and McGee was 25, so that was all 48.
It was also, to me, significant that Tyson Chandler, in his first game for the Lakers, just joined the team. I can't remember if it was on Tuesday or Wednesday, technically, they cleared waivers and basically immediately joined the Lakers. But why he was out there for those offensive rebounds, my instinct was the reason they did that is because they thought Minnesota was going to just run a play and they didn't want JaVale McGee out there defensively.
Yeah, he was getting taken advantage of in pick and roll a little bit towards the end there.
Right. So, I mean, it's not an important statement because, I mean, you and I have a lot of familiarity with JaVale McGee, especially the last couple of years. But, I mean, every once in a while, there's this little bit of buzz that JaVale is better defensively, and it's like, well, another team chose a guy who joined the team basically today to play over him because they thought there might be a defensive possession.
Yeah, also in some of the post game stuff, Rondo was basically like telling Chandler where to go on every possession at the end, so maybe that's part of why he was in. And Rondo and Ball's combined line is hilarious. 2 out of 13, 16 assists, 11 rebounds, and 6 turnovers. combined 0-4 from 3. All right, I don't have much more on this one, unless you do. Should we get to news here?
Yeah, let's go to news.
So a lot of the stuff we're getting for this news segment actually is from Sean Strani of The Athletic, and I was really interested to see, because I follow NBA media very closely. I mean, I probably consume more of it than just about anyone. I mean, I spend probably three hours a day at a minimum just reading about the NBA, and The Athletic is probably where I'm reading like at least half of my stuff at this point. And so Shams is someone who obviously is a great reporter. Here's a lot of stuff. And so I wondered how they're going to translate that skill into his writing. And so what they did is he's got this column now called Inside Pass. And he talked about the Jimmy Butler saga again, gave us some early additional details on the Heat's offer and saying, hey, you know what? Josh Richardson is averaging 22 a game and he's on a way better contract than Butler. You know, maybe he is more valuable than Butler just on his own at this point. And then that the Rockets package, they weren't interested in that. It included Brandon Knight and Marquise Chris. That's all really interesting stuff. Also said that at least 7 teams are monitoring Terry Rozier's status this season. But, you know, it doesn't look like the Celtics are going to try to move. The Suns have really aggressively pursued Rozier, apparently. And then he's got just news and notes from around the NBA where he's got a lot of interesting stuff here that Dwayne Dedman could be a trade candidate, which, you know, kind of makes sense. Kemba Walker, not a trade candidate. Dirk Nowitzki is going to try and be back in 3 weeks, which is a little bit less than what we'd heard elsewhere. The Nuggets actually tried to get into the Kawhi talks. I mean, there's just, he's got, you know, 10 or 15 of these nuggets in here. It's really good stuff, and worth reading the entire column. You know, it's not all on Twitter anymore, which is a smart business move, but it would be a smart move for you to sign up for The Athletic at theathletic.com/capspace, easier/capspace, because we talk about it all the time on the program. And of course, you'll get all of Danny's stuff. You wrote that Oladipo piece, so you should tell the people about that.
Yeah, so this is the one I alluded to on yesterday's broadcast. Basically, I was doing some digging over the summer and realized that the delay from the Paul George Oladipo Sabonis trade being reported / agreed to and actually being consummated was 1 week, but that 1 week carried over the league year. And by carrying over the league year, that means that by the letter of the law in the CBA, Victor Oladipo is ineligible for a designated veteran contract or extension, even if he fulfills all the other requirements. And so what the piece is about is laying out that case and, you know, going through some of the consequences that could be eventually felt because of that. And for those who are interested in it, there is also I'm calling it an audio companion to it, where I lay out not only the piece itself, but also my research process and some of the other things, because people are often interested in that. And so it's not just the piece and explaining it, it's also kind of how it came into being. And so that's only available for subscribers as well.
Yeah, once again, theathletic.com/capspace. Let's get to the rest of the news here. One thing, John Schumann tweeting this out, and I thought it was really interesting. I just subjectively had noticed this. And again, you know, we had some games today that were both slower and more defensively oriented, and both the offensive efficiency league-wide and the pace have been dropping. Week one, crazy pace, 103. Now we're down to 99 in week four across 13 games. And this was before today, too. We saw some slower pace games again today. And then offensive efficiency normally rises throughout the season, but it was 109.6 in week one. Now it's down to 107.7. So these are more normal numbers for the league that are not just like crazily above last year. It'd be interesting to monitor those trends as we continue. In Boston, Kyrie Irving fined $25,000 for the NBA for throwing the ball into the stands after he was annoyed at Jamal Murray, who first missed a layup to get his 50 and then tried a three with the shot clock off. Oh my God! Unwritten rule of basketball. And so Irving got all pissed off and threw the ball into the stands. I guess the idea being that he wouldn't get to keep the ball from his 48-point game. I've agitated the cat by my annoyance with these stupid unwritten rules of basketball. Like, just be a man. Like, don't let the guy get 48 points if you're worried about him going for 50. I mean, basketball is fun. People, like, Kyrie of all people shouldn't be getting on someone for, like, caring about stats, since that's basically, he was a very stat focused player for his first few years in the league.
Well, and I'm hoping that for the sake of Devin Booker, that he wasn't at the game when Booker dropped 70, a significant portion of that in garbage time. I mean, to me, that is a lot more egregious than a guy taking one or two extra shots when he's at 48. And as you said, and Jalen Rose said this too, and he knows this better than almost anybody, if you don't want somebody to get to a round number, stop them a couple of possessions before that. So again, I think this kind of stuff is silly, and I understand the fine. No problem with that. I would say the most important piece of news that happened since the last time we did this is Russell Westbrook. So Westbrook had an ankle injury. It looked bad. We were watching in the media room at Oracle because that game was on, I believe, NBA TV before Warriors Wolves, and it looked bad. Thankfully, according to Royce Young, it looks like it's an ankle sprain and nothing more. He did not play in Wednesday night's game against Cleveland. He is traveling with the team and they're figuring out a timeline. I'm guessing, based on the reporting that Royce has and everything else, like, he'll come back at some point next week, and that is a whole lot better than I feared it would be, and Oklahoma City relies on him a whole lot.
Yeah, there was a report, which I'm not sure what the source on it was, from Jen Hale, who is the Pelicans sideline reporter, and the Pelicans were playing in that game against OKC, that it was a high ankle sprain, and that, I tweeted at the time, if that's true, we're looking at 3 or 4 weeks here for a high ankle sprain, but no, it's just, a normal inversion ankle sprain for Westbrook. I mean, I was worried about it because he landed with his full weight on that ankle. It wasn't like one of those ones where, like, you're running and you take a step and sprain it. Like, he landed from a jump on it. But he also is an absolute machine. And so I think if anyone's going to heal quickly, it'll be him. That would be my guess. It's just, middle of next week. We'll see him. I thought the biggest news was that we're going to have to retire the whole voice of head coach sock puppet thing. Larry Drew and the Cavs agreed on a deal for the rest of the season, and then also a partial guarantee for next season. So we'll see how this year plays out. And, I haven't heard of coaching contracts with partial guarantees before, although, we don't have access to those the way we do player contracts. But that seems like a fair solution. Not clear exactly how much of a bump he got for this year either, but this is kind of where it seemed like this was going to end up, and good job for those guys coming up with a somewhat creative solution to resolve the issue. And now, unfortunately, Drew has to coach the team for the rest of the game.
And he will be coaching that team without Sam Decker for 2 to 4 weeks. He has an ankle sprain. George Hill was a late scratch against OKC, which led to Colin Sexton starting that game, and then Jetty Osman left the game early due to back spasms. So they are beyond the walking wounded at this point, with Kevin Love, of course, already being out, and other guys just dealing with issues. Yeah.
Oh,
and unfortunately,
are you still on Cleveland here? One other thing on that. Go ahead.
You go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I will go ahead. This is great radio. We talked about on the 15 and 60, like, comparing this team with that first post-LeBron season in Cleveland. That team was devastated by injuries, too. I mean, they had some established NBA players, and those guys just all got hurt. And, that seems like this year's Cavs team is heading in that exact same direction. And you would have thought that maybe without Westbrook, this team could have been, and they were competitive tonight at home, but, we're not able to pick up the win. What else we got here?
What I was leading into was, unfortunately for basically all of us, Thursday's headline game of Milwaukee Golden State lost a little bit of luster because Draymond Green will not play. He missed the end of their win over Memphis with what was called a right foot contusion. Now it is being classified as a toe injury. He is out completely. Sean Livingston is also out. Andre Iguodala will return.
Not believed to be serious, by the way, for Draymond. More of a day-to-day
thing. And it's kind of the same thing with Livingston, where I think they're using an abundance of caution because their season is not going to be defined by the next couple of days or weeks. So I think the next place to go is their prime competition, maybe not right now in terms of record, but Houston's dealing with some interesting stuff.
Yeah, Eric Gordon could be back for Thursday night against the Thunder. He's questionable with that groin issue, and I think one of the biggest reasons that they have gotten better, obviously they got Harden back, they got Ennis back, but they also have been able to excise Michael Carter-Williams from the rotation completely. He's gotten DNPs the last couple of games. They've been getting some minutes from Gary Clark, which has helped. So just getting a completely awful player out of the rotation a lot of times can have an outsized effect. For the Clippers, they have perhaps the most guard depth in the league, and they will be using some of that with Avery Bradley out with an ankle sprain. He's been in a walking boot, so he's already been ruled out against Portland on Thursday, and you have to imagine that it'll be at least a couple of weeks there. Luka Mbamute is still also out for Thursday against Portland as well, but Doc Rivers says he will be back soon, whatever that means.
Someone who is already back, thankfully, Bogdan Bogdanovic returned for the Sacramento Kings in their closer than I would say anticipated loss to the Toronto Raptors, 9 points at the Golden One Center. Bogdanovic played 18 minutes, was 3 of 7 from the field. I did not get to watch the game to see how he looked, but a guy who just can help that team, another capable perimeter player, is always welcome there. And in a game that we didn't get to watch much of, Hassan Whiteside had a crazy stat line. Both San Antonio and Miami ended up with some unusual lineups. Miami's was due to Goran Dragic not playing, so they went with this lineup, starting five involving Wayne Ellington and Richardson being their backup guards. And then San Antonio is dealing with Rudy Gay still not playing, and they actually started Derek White, who returned, and Bryn Forbes together, and their starters got worked so hard by Miami that they did a hockey sub pretty early in that game, and Hassan Whiteside ended up with a completely appalling stat line, which I'm going to pull up now because it warrants inclusion on this podcast. 29 points, 20 rebounds, 9 blocks, and most importantly, 2 assists, and he missed his only 3.
I think he had 8 of those blocks in the first half, too.
Yeah, I think so.
Milwaukee, in an expected move, requested cap relief at the moment they were able to, 1 year after he last played for Mirza Teletovic. They had previously stretched the last $10 million or so that they owed Teletovic when they waived him last season. He, of course, had to retire due to pulmonary issues. He is now actually officially retired. He has accepted a position as the head of the Bosnian Federation. And so the effect there, if the long-term injury exclusion is granted, which appears likely with Teletovic having retired, will be that Milwaukee will save about $3.5 million in salary this year, at least towards the luxury tax. They still have to pay him, but it won't count on their cap. So they'll get up to $8 million in space now below the tax. Probably wouldn't have impacted them either way, but they have a little bit more maneuvering room now to make some trades, potentially. They already took on Jody Meeks, of course, with a trade exception. So they want to... any ways I don't think left to take on players other than just in salary matching, but they could do a lopsided salary trade, and then opens up another $3.5 million in cap space for their exploits next summer. They likely will be trying to retain guys, stay over the cap, but now they'll have a little more breathing room below the tax there. In New Orleans, Elfrid Payton still didn't play tonight, but could be back Saturday against the Suns. New Orleans desperately needed a win against the Bulls and got one with Anthony Davis, a slump-busting 32-17. In New York, Courtney Lee's strange saga continues. He's supposed to be reevaluated again with that neck injury in a week. I mean, it's been, you know, essentially since camp that he has had this, and we haven't gotten a real understanding of what the issue is. What else we got here?
Jonathan Isaac still dealing with this ankle issue, and looks like, you know, maybe another week or so for him, which is unfortunate. They've been starting Wes Iwundu in his place, and they actually went out to lead against the Pistons, but ended up losing that game 103-90. 76. In Toronto, they got Kawhi back against Sacramento in a game they won by 9. But CJ Miles didn't play due to right hip bursitis. And Norman Powell is expected to miss 4 to 6 weeks with left shoulder subluxation, which even though your issues are lower body, you have a better chance of figuring out what this is compared to me.
Yeah, I think it's basically like a separated shoulder, essentially. But
a quick Google search said a partial dislocation.
I'm always forget the difference between a separation and a dislocation when it comes to shoulder injuries. I'm better with the lower body stuff. The shoulder, I'm not as good at. But he's to miss 4 to 6 weeks with that injury, and those could be kind of tricky too, because you know sometimes you need to have surgery. Sometimes you can just kind of try to rehab it and play, but it's not really 100%. So too bad for Powell. Although if any team can withstand that loss, it is the Raptors. And did we do Philly yet?
We did not, because it didn't really have an impact on the game, which we broke down earlier. Mike Muscala broke his nose in practice, so he is out for the next week. And Sharsh, it was good that he performed as well as he did in Muscala's absence. Yeah. I mean, not that those guys are necessarily competing for minutes, but Muscala did close instead of Sharsh against the Pistons. And then Furkan Korkmaz, they declined his third-year team option. And now, unsurprisingly, he has requested a trade because, I mean, you want to try to build up some of that value, and he is far outside of their rotation at the moment.
Yeah, but unfortunately for him, there's not much incentive to trade for him at this point, because if he does get into a rotation, any team that trades for him could only pay him the value of what the declined option would have been, which would have been somewhere, you know, in the $2 million range. He was a pretty low pick. I think he was 26th overall. I mean, I think you almost, if you're Korkmaz, might want to just request your release. Might be more realistic. And Philly is always looking for roster spots. I mean, I think they'll keep him around. You know, if Shamet goes down, they might need him a little bit. But you know, kind of too bad for Korkmaz. I do think that he has some talent, you know, could come in, but it is more of a fit on a team that's not trying to win now, necessarily. Anything else there? Are we done?
Two quick things. One, unfortunately for Furkan Korkmaz, his dad does not run the personnel for an NBA team, so it's unlikely that he'll get like a 1+1 and then make a bunch of money on the next contract like Austin Rivers did. And that's a good point about demanding or asking for his release, because as I understand it, that would actually enable a team to re-sign him. I mean, they probably would just use cap space anyway, but at least they wouldn't be subject to the restriction. That is the case here. And then the other piece of news, happy to see Donovan Mitchell return. Utah beat Dallas 117-102, and that included an emphatic Donovan Mitchell dunk over, around, however we want to put it, Maxi Kleba, which was not as good as the Sabonis dunk, but was certainly worthy of consideration and will be worthy of consideration in the Dunked On Monthly Awards Dunk of the Month, which will be in early December.
Oh, one other thing too. All-Star Draft going to be televised, say Mark Stein and Kevin Draper of the New York Times, which is awesome. I'm glad that they managed to do that. I might even watch. I usually don't watch these like selection show, award show things, but
we'll just have to make sure that we do ours ahead of time.
Yeah. And then we January 31st. So we got to do it like a couple days beforehand. And then we can talk about how we're so much better GMs than the players are.
Yeah.
All right. That'll do it for today. Good, fun, long show. We will close the week out tomorrow. A long awaited episode. Is it time for bad teams to panic? We will tell you tomorrow. Till then.